This person has four foundations. They are the foundation of wisdom, the foundation of truth, the foundation of relinquishment, and the foundation of peace. One should not neglect wisdom, should preserve truth, should cultivate relinquishment, and train for peace. How does one not neglect wisdom? That's the question, rhetorical question the Buddha posed, because he went on to answer, to offer a reflection. So what is wisdom? The word wisdom in our usual language has a lot of meanings, and we can have a knowledge. Sometimes wisdom and knowledge are used to mean the same thing, and we can have knowledge about many things. You know, knowledge about how to drive or how to write or how to sew. We wouldn't normally say one is wise about sewing. And wisdom in the context, we might though say somebody is wise about how they engage with people or how they conduct themselves. In the context of what the Buddha taught, the meaning of wisdom is pretty specific. And the Buddha said, "What I teach is suffering and the end of suffering." And so the wisdom, the orientation of wise view that the Buddha offered relates to suffering and the end of suffering. One of the main framings of wisdom, when wisdom is defined, often, you know, one of the main places wisdom is defined is in the first path factor. The Eightfold Path begins with wise view, which is basically wisdom. Wise perspective, wise direction, wise orientation of understanding around suffering, around what causes suffering, around how suffering arises and how suffering ends. One of the main definitions of suffering in this context is the Four Noble Truths. It's defined as the truth of suffering, the truth of the cause of suffering or the arising of suffering, the truth of the ending of suffering, and the truth of the path leading to the ending of suffering. And so on the surface of it, perhaps these this statement, the truth of suffering, does that sound like wisdom? It is when it's kind of embedded in the whole context of what the Buddha was searching for. You know, when he started his journey, that was his whole search. Might it be possible? Is it possible to be free of suffering, of this suffering that human beings seem to be endlessly caught in? And so there is suffering. This statement, the First Noble Truth, is a statement of the kind of the human condition. that we do suffer. Not all the time, necessarily, but that suffering is a kind of a part and parcel of human experience. We're born, we age, we die, our loved ones die, we're separated from what we love, there's illness. And so this truth of this very ordinary aspect of human life, the Buddha asked, is this possible to have freedom around this suffering? And so his wisdom, the wisdom that he points to throughout his teaching, points to what he understood around this question. Is it possible to be free from suffering? The second noble truth states there's a kind of a reason or conditions around which suffering arise. And that the third noble truth says that those conditions can end. The condition of craving is the arising of suffering. When there's craving in the mind, suffering arises in the mind. When the mind holds on to, wants things to be different than they are in this moment, there's suffering. And the release of that craving is the release of that suffering, the third noble truth, the possibility of release from that suffering. And the fourth noble truth, that there is a path, there is a way to freedom. And we could restate these four noble truths in kind of a more everyday language, perhaps. We all, I think, have a sense, somewhat frequently even, that things are just kind of off. They're not quite right. So we could look at the Four Noble Truths as being this feeling of offness, this feeling that things aren't, that it just aren't quite right, that feeling. That feeling of offness is created by our own minds. And it's possible to change our minds. So to me, these Four Noble Truths are a great beacon of hope in our lives, this possibility for freedom from suffering. Embedded in this description of the Four Noble Truths, the cause or the that suffering arises when craving arises. Craving in other contexts is understood as not only just wanting things, but also wanting to get rid of things. So both this greed and this aversion in the mind and confusion in the mind. The whole idea that I need something, you know, the whole notion that if I have this thing, you know, the wanting, the craving, the greed for having something is predicated on the belief that having that thing will make me happy. Or if we don't want something, if we want to get rid of it, that whole notion of aversion is predicated on the belief that actually getting rid of that thing will make me happy. And that's the, maybe what we could say, the delusion of greed, is that it believes that it's fully bought into, if I get that thing, I'll be happy. Then we see, you know, we see in exploring our minds, we watch our minds and we see we get something for, you know, we get something that we want. And for a moment, there's some sense of happiness or ease or relief. And how long does it last? And so we have that moment of, things are okay in this moment. Things are fine. And then in the next moment, or a few moments, That feeling of gratification fades. And again, that feeling of offness comes back. And we're off searching again, searching for something to get rid of, searching for something to have. And so embedded in the Four Noble Truths is really an understanding of certain qualities of mind, certain states of mind, that of greed, aversion, and delusion, are involved in this pattern of suffering. And that when we act out of greed, aversion, and delusion, we are conditioning the mind to be caught by the pattern of wanting more things, wanting to get rid of more things. Essentially, the acting out of the pattern of aversion, for instance, believing and following through on the belief that getting rid of that thing will make me happy. When we get that split second of that moment or two or three of ease after we've gotten rid of something, a feeling of, oh, I'm in control, I can be in control of my life. We have a few moments of that ease. And then there's the next moment of, and what else is there? We've conditioned, essentially acting out of that, in that pattern of getting rid. If I get rid of what I don't want, that'll make me happy. If I get what I want, that'll make me happy. Conditions the belief that the way to happiness is the having and getting rid of. And so we just end up on this cycle. And so the embedded in this understanding of the Four Noble Truths is this recognition of these states of mind that tend to keep conditioning, keep heading us in the direction of suffering. And that there are the opposing states of mind, non-greed, non-aversion, non-delusion, that will lead us towards happiness, freedom from suffering. And so this is an aspect of wisdom that the Buddha points to. There's the conditioned nature of suffering, that it arises with greed, aversion, and delusion. It ends as those end. As we see sometimes too, and just in a small example, you know, you might see this. If you are willing sometime to recognize perhaps a small wanting, you know, some wanting that's arising in your mind about, oh, seconds, for instance, at lunch. You know, maybe you see that desire to get seconds. You might play, maybe one day this week, with not acting on that desire and instead watching the wanting, seeing that feeling of wanting, seeing how that feeling of wanting itself is a feeling of offness. That wanting, the story that wanting is telling us in that moment when we're caught by it is, yeah, seconds, that's going to make me happy. I'm not going to be happy if I don't have seconds. It's telling us that story. And if we believe that story, we'll follow through on it. This is a really, you know, silly, simple example, but it actually can teach us a lot if we're willing to look at it. And so suppose you don't act on that wanting one day. Just watch it. Feel the pull. Feel the magnetic pull towards the table. You know, that's kind of what it feels like, right? It's like, especially if there's something sweet over there, you know, it's like, ooh. We feel ourselves orient towards it. It's almost like there's this, you know, draw. That's the feeling of wanting, that pull, that feeling. Can you sit with it? There's a little bit of a discomfort to it because it wants to be satisfied. Desire wants to be satisfied. So you feel into that. And at some point, if you're willing to just watch it, you know, something might distract you and then you'll forget for a moment and then you'll be up, you know, something else arises in your mind and you'll be up doing something else. And maybe, you know, a couple hours later you think, where's that wanting for that having seconds at lunch? And it's gone. You know, it wasn't satisfied. and it's gone. Where's the suffering around not having seconds? It's gone. It's more powerful if from time to time you might actually be able to watch the wanting and actually see it disappear. Now, this can happen occasionally. If you're willing to hang out with watching a state of mind, just watch that pull, watch that pull, watch that pull. Sit there until they've cleared all the food away. When the food is no longer there, what happens to that wanting? Likely, it goes away. You may get to actually watch it go away and then see very directly that wanting itself is the suffering. It's not the not having that's the suffering. It's the wanting. And so we start to understand how these mind states of greed, aversion, and delusion actually lead us towards suffering. So there's that aspect around suffering and the mind states that lead us to suffering. And there's also embedded in the Four Noble Truths an understanding of the conditions. That suffering doesn't arise kind of randomly. It arises in dependence on conditions. And the conditions for the arising of suffering is the arising of greed, aversion, delusion in the mind. So there are these kind of understandings of wisdom related to suffering in the Four Noble Truths. The teachings also point to a kind of an evolution of wisdom in our practice. That, this is expressed to some extent in the Eightfold Path, in that the very first factor of the Eightfold Path, the Eightfold Path describing the path that supports the conditions for freedom, a wise view, wise intention, wise speech, wise action, wise livelihood, wise effort, wise mindfulness, wise concentration. These are the practices, essentially, we cultivate. And this path begins with wise view. So the path begins with wisdom. But the beginning of the path with wisdom isn't an expectation that suddenly we have, like, absorbed this wisdom and we have the wisdom integrated into our system. It's more that we take in this teaching. We hear the teaching. We hear a perspective that's different than our usual perspective. I really think of the wisdom of the Buddha as being an alternative perspective about life and what would lead to happiness. Our kind of habitual way of finding happiness in life is, yeah, if I get what I want, that'll make me happy. If I get what I don't want, that'll make me happy. If I string enough moments of those together, that's as good as it gets. The perspective of the Buddha is these qualities of greed, aversion, and delusion, the things that we act on that we think will bring us happiness, it's those very things that lead us to non-happiness. And so understanding this, the first we just have to hear it. We have to take in this different perspective. And then maybe we have to think about it. Does it make sense to me? Does it resonate? You know, when I first heard this notion of, one of the very first books I read about Buddhist practice offered a little bit of wisdom that I could understand intellectually, but had no idea how it worked. And that little bit of wisdom was, try just recognizing that a reactive mind state is happening instead of following through on it. Try just knowing reactivity is happening. And for me at that time, anger was a big issue. You know, I was being ruled by anger. I was finding myself frozen in front of my computer, unable to move because I was so angry. So anger was really creating some non-functional, dysfunctional patterns in my life. And I was curious about how to work with it. And I got this book. You know, this book came in the mail. And I read it and thought, okay, well, what this is telling me is to pay attention to that anger. My initial response was, what good is that going to do? You know, I had no idea why that would be helpful. But at the same time, you know, in my life at that time, I had tried everything else I could think of. Every wise thing I could have heard, I had tried, and it hadn't helped with my suffering around the anger. And so it's like, well, I don't get it, but I'm willing to give it a try. And so this was the beginning of taking that wisdom that was heard, you know, try, essentially, you know, in the parlance of the Four Noble Truths, you know, aversion is arising. You know, can you recognize that aversion is arising and leading to suffering in this moment? It would be a description of what the Four Noble Truths say to do around something like anger. Understand anger by turning to it, by experiencing it. See how suffering arises in relationship to it. And so, you know, hearing this, I did not have any sense that it would be valuable to do that, but I just figured might as well try something because nothing else has worked. And so I was willing to explore it. So this is, you know, this is a little bit of thinking about, right? Thinking about the teaching, reflecting on it. Doesn't make much sense, but well, okay. Nothing else has made much sense either, so let's just give it a go. And then, you know, beginning to explore it, beginning to put it into practice, beginning to see what does it mean to turn towards this experience of arising anger. So this is a second kind of level of wisdom. We hear the teachings, and they at least perhaps make enough sense for us to try them out, to turn towards them. Wisdom, I think, in this practice, it is practice. It's not about just hearing something and saying, oh, that makes sense. It's asking. The wisdom of the Buddha is asking to be engaged with. And so the second bit of it, the second bit of wisdom, or the next deepening of wisdom, has to do with that engagement. We start to play with it. We start to try it. We start to explore it. As we start to explore it, we start to directly understand why it's helpful. So for myself, you know, it's like very quickly, it did not take long before the mind understood why it was useful to turn towards anger. It wasn't something that I, you know, consciously could say, oh, this is the reason. But what I began to experience is that I was getting less angry. This simple practice created the conditions for less anger in my life. It created the conditions for, you know, a more normal kind of anger, not the kind of anger that I'd end up like frozen in front of the computer, unable to move. I would see a wave of anger and be able to, you know, let it go through and move on. And so saw very quickly the benefit, saw very quickly how this practice was supportive. And the deepening of it further is when we begin to understand in direct experience the You know, we understand not only just that it's a good idea, that it makes sense to do the practice, but we viscerally get in our bones how it leads to freedom. And so in my own case, in this, you know, this first few months of practice, the moment of understanding how a thought in my mind was headed in the direction of anger. And seeing a thought come up in the mind and feeling this urge to like jump on that thought and get angry at the person that I was angry with. And yet, what happened in that moment, because I'd spent so much time hanging out there, you know, with that anger, noticing, oh, this is anger. This is the arising of anger. Noticing that was suffering. You know, before I had made that shift of turning towards the anger, when anger arose, I was like so into it. I was like, yeah, that person shouldn't have done that, and here's what I'm going to do to them, and this is how they need to be instructed, and this is why I'm right. And the mind was fully invested in that and completely unaware of the suffering that was happening here. And so this is, again, how wisdom points. Wisdom and suffering are intimately connected here. You know, wisdom arises in relationship to meeting suffering. And we have to meet suffering. And this is that first noble truth. This is suffering. You know, it sounds obvious, but it really hit me over the head at one point. It's like, oh my gosh, this anger hurts. This anger is suffering. It hurts me. I've got this idea that it's going to hurt that person. You know, it's going to, somehow this anger is going to like make that person miserable, but it's, boy, it's, and actually in some ways I was really lucky because I was in the Peace Corps. I was in the South Pacific. I was on the middle of an island in the South Pacific, and the guy that I was angry with was 7,000 miles away. And, you know, I was sitting there stewing in rage, and he had no idea. Clearly wasn't hurting him at all. So, really became clear, this is suffering. And that's an insight. You know, it's an insight. It's an understanding. This is suffering. It's an understanding that arises in the meeting of, the turning towards, the willingness to be with what's arising here, not shrinking from it, and in a way honoring it. You know, it's honoring what's actually happening. We're not trying to repress it. We're not trying to get rid of it. We're trying to understand it. That's what the Buddha said in his First Noble Truth. Understand suffering. That's what we need to do. Understand it. And so we open to whatever's arising here and explore the possibility of meeting that, not rejecting it, not being averse to it, but opening to it, understanding it, seeing how it lands in the system. And so this is this, you know, this recognition of wisdom becomes a much deeper experience. And so this, again, as I said, this kind of levels of wisdom that unfold through our practice as we engage. We hear the teachings, we reflect on it, we put them into practice, and then we directly understand something. That direct understanding then kind of fuels us to keep going, to keep exploring, keep investigating, keep recognizing what's happening here. So in our sutta that Gil introduced yesterday, at this point when the Buddha asks rhetorically, how does one not neglect wisdom? There's a kind of a shift in the sutta as Gil pointed out, yesterday it began with the Buddhists kind of describing the experience of awake. You know, he didn't say, I am, but he said, you know, this person is experienced in this way. And then asking or pointing to, and how does one not neglect wisdom? So he basically points, he's going through these practices, these four practices that he pointed to, not neglecting wisdom, cultivating, preserving truth, cultivating relinquishment and training for peace. And he proceeds to describe to Bukkasati how to do that. And in my read of this text, he does this basically by offering a guided meditation. As I read what follows here, it sounds to me like, you know, they're sitting there, right? They're sitting there, as Gil described, late into the night, into the early morning together, sitting there, and the Buddha's speaking, and you can envision it being very dark, so Bukkasati probably has his eyes closed, and he's listening to the Buddha, and the Buddha starts describing what's in this body. There are these kinds of sensations, these kinds of experiences. There's the element of earth, heavy, weight, dense, solid. There's the element of water, flowing, liquid, fluid, cohesive. There's the element of air, movement, vibration, pressure, pulsing. There's the element of heat, temperature. And so it seems to me that he's pointing Bukkasati directly into experience. Touch into your experience. What's happening here? In one instance, it says, the earth element is simply earth element. And it's repeated for each one. The water element is simply water element. To me, this in more modern language, Carl Sagan said this beautifully. The nitrogen in our DNA, the calcium in our teeth, the iron in our blood, the carbon in our apple pies were made in the interiors of collapsing stars. We are made of star stuff. That's what we are. In the Buddha's words, he was pointing to just, there's just this stuff. No different than a tree or an apple pie. This stuff was forged in the center of a star. And with each of the elements, he again points to, you should reflect, this is not mine. This I am not. This is not myself. So again, really pointing to the impersonal nature of our experience. We are star stuff. It's not mine. It was forged in stars. It didn't belong to the stars either. The stars, it was a process of star creation. Just a natural process. And here we are, the result of natural process with all of this stuff. To me, this recalls another teaching that again points us to direct experience, points us to seeing our experience in the moment, very simply. It's a teaching to another wandering monastic, another wandering ascetic called Bahia. And the teaching goes something like this. Bahia asks the Buddha for a teaching in brief. Bahia says, you know, He basically interrupts the Buddha on his alms round and says, Will you teach me the Dharma? And the Buddha said, I'm getting ready to go to offer alms round, Bahia, you know, can it wait? And Bahia asks him three times, and basically in there says, we never know how long we have. And after the third request, the Buddha offers him the teaching in brief, and he says, this is how you should train yourself. In the seen is only the seen, in the heard is only the heard, in the sensed is only the sensed, in the cognized is only the cognized. This is how you should train yourself. Basically, recognizing whatever is seen, heard, sensed, cognized as simply an arising experience. Not me, not mine, just this is what's arising in this moment. Thoughts arising in this moment. Moods arising in this moment. Body sensations arising in this moment, really just pointing to direct experience happening now. This is not so easy. We have a strong habit of overlaying concepts, beliefs, actually experiencing things through concepts, through beliefs. You know, sometimes when I ask people to describe experience, I'll say, well, what are you experiencing right now? And they might say something like, well, I'm experiencing my shoulder. And I'll ask a little bit like, well, what is the experience there in the shoulder? Is there pressure? Is there pulling? Is there tension? Is there burning? Because shoulder is an idea. There is no sensation shoulder. All there is pressure, heat, tension, coolness, burning, tingling, pulsing. And yet often we overlay the idea and are experiencing in a way we don't experience the direct kind of moment-to-moment experience because we're thinking about it. So it's not so easy to begin to touch into this more elemental experience the Buddha was pointing to both Phukkasati and to Bahia. To Bahia, he goes on to say, when for you, in the seen is only the seen, in the heard is only the heard, in the sensed is only the sensed, in the cognized is only the cognized, then there's no you in terms of that. When there's no you in terms of that, there's no you there. And this is the end of suffering. So again, pointing to this understanding of non-identification. This is not me, not mine, not who I am. In the Bahia Sutta, I like the way it's pointed to in the Bahia Sutta because it doesn't ask us to believe it. It just says, see if you can know this. Train yourself to recognize. Seeing is just seeing. Hearing is just hearing. Sensing, body, touch, taste, smell is just sensing. Thoughts, emotions, moods are just an arising experience in the moment. And when that has been done thoroughly, you will understand there is no you in terms of that. It's like we don't have to believe it. We just have to experience that understanding will become more clear. And so this is one way that the Buddha points to not neglecting wisdom to Phukkasati. He says, notice your direct experience. In the sutta with Phukkasati, he points also to see it as not me, not mine, not who I am. This could be understood as using wisdom as a reflection, bringing it in almost consciously. Initially, as we start to explore our experience, we are seeing it from the perspective of, this is my pain, or this is my, I'm the one experiencing this delightful taste. Rather than delightful taste is happening, pleasant taste is happening. It's like, ooh, more of that. I'd like more of that. And so the Buddhists suggest to Pukkasati, as you experience things, oh, pain in the knee. This is not mine. Essentially, this is simply the arising of sensation. This is not me. This is not mine. This is not who I am. Perhaps even using it as a conscious reflection. This is another way that we can not neglect wisdom, by bringing in some of the teachings that we've heard or understood consciously. Some main areas of wisdom. Now, there's the conditioned nature of experience. There's the impermanent nature of experience. There's the unreliable nature of experience. We might reflect as something is happening, it can be helpful to reflect, oh, this is impermanent. Just as a reminder, this is impermanent. Or this is just a set of processes tumbling on. One of my favorite wisdom reflections that supports my practice is just as a reminder to myself, whatever's arising, maybe it's depression. Depression's arising. A reflection, I pointed to it earlier in the talk, this is not random. This state of mind that's arising right now is dependent on causes and conditions. It's dependent on a variety of conditions from my life, from how I was met on the playground, how many friends I had or didn't have, how my family interacted with me, what my, so many conditions. It might also depend on the weather. There's conditions that impact us. I remember at one time I was practicing in IMS, and I was noticing a lot of depression and loneliness descend as I was doing walking meditation. And one day, as I was doing walking meditation in the basement at IMS, which is a very gray room, nobody else was in there, and there are just these little tiny windows at the top, and I looked outside, and it was a gray day. It was cold. There were no leaves on the trees. It was like, cold outside, and I recognized to some extent that my mood was arising in dependence on the weather and the fact that I couldn't walk outside anymore. It was too cold for me. So many conditions come together to create the arising. Actually, in that moment, it's like, wow, this depression is like just as related to the trees. It's like, so there was an understanding. This is nature. This reflection, this is nature. What's arising right now? It's like, the unfolding of the seasons. It's conditioned based on so many things happening in the past. It's also conditioned based on, what's my relationship in this moment? Am I believing? Am I believing something? Am I believing that, oh, poor me, because here I am by myself in the basement and I don't have anybody to talk to because I put myself on this 3-month retreat and I'm really... It's arising in dependence on those conditions too. The reflection for me, oh, right, this is what's happening, this is nature, somehow has a powerful impact on the mind to remind me it's not personal. It's simply unfolding conditions. And actually, this conditionality of experience is the second wisdom pointing in this text. And the Buddha points to the conditional or the impersonal nature of the elements of our experience. And then he starts talking about processes in the mind. And in particular, you know, he points to every experience we have arises in dependence on conditions. In particular, he points to the conditionality of pleasant, unpleasant, and neutral. A pleasant condition arises when there's a pleasant experience arises when there's a contact with some experience that the mind considers pleasant. The conditioned arising of pleasant, unpleasant, neutral, the passing of pleasant, unpleasant, neutral when those experiences pass. So this pointing to the conditionality of pleasant, unpleasant, neutral is a powerful gateway to equanimity, to a mind that is not buffeted around by pleasant, unpleasant, neutral. Often as we're going through our lives, pleasant, unpleasant, neutral happen, and we feel like we're just blown around by these experiences. It's like, oh, poor me, why me? Why am I experiencing all of these unpleasant things? And these pleasant things, they come and they only stay for a short time. Why me? It's like, this is the human condition. This is the way it is. And the Buddha points to the conditionality of feeling that can support leading to a sense of kind of stability rather than feeling buffeted around by pleasant, unpleasant, neutral. There's a sense of, yeah, pleasant feeling arises, it's pleasant feeling, it passes. Unpleasant feeling arises, it's unpleasant, it passes. Neutral feeling arises, it passes. So a deep pointing to a balance of mind that's possible. So practical wisdom. You know, sometimes as I hear this word wisdom, I think, you know, it, especially early in my practice, it's like it seemed like something so grand. It's like maybe someday I'll have wisdom. There's so many simple ways that we can bring this into our practice. And in fact, the way we explore mindfulness, the Buddha's teaching on mindfulness, integrates wisdom right into the instruction. The simplicity of recognizing there's, you know, to essentially turn towards experience, to know it. Oh, this is the arising of reactivity. This is the arising of anger. That shift that I talked about earlier that I experienced, the difference between being caught in the anger and believing it and kind of heading towards doing something around it because of the anger, and the recognition of, oh, this is anger. Vast difference between those two internally. And this is part of the pointing, you know, that we learn how to recognize experience as experience. Pleasant experiences arising and being known. Thoughts are arising and being known. Sensations arising and being known. Emotions, reactivity arising and being known. Begins to cultivate a balanced mind. Well, we could say perhaps a non-reactive mind, a mind that's not buffeted around by pleasant, unpleasant, and neutral, not buffeted around by things we don't want, things we want to get rid of, not buffeted around by wanting to hold on to things. So a non-reactive mind. And yet, so often in hearing that or talking about a non-reactive mind, people hear that and think it means, oh, well, all we're supposed to do is just sit here. It's like being equanimous means just sitting here, or, you know, it's like being a lump. You know, it's non-reactivity means we don't do anything. And to me, that is not what the teachings point to. Because as we deeply open to experience, as we deeply recognize what's happening, the mind begins to loosen its grip on reactivity. And in the loosening its grip on reactivity, other states of mind begin to come forth. States like compassion. Compassion often arises in connection with suffering. We see someone suffering. We experience suffering ourselves. And the mind that is open and non-reactive doesn't kind of flail around with that experience of suffering, but opens to it with compassion. And compassion acts. Wisdom acts. We so often think that, you know, if I weren't reactive, I wouldn't do anything. You know, it's like our whole notion of how we engage in the world is often predicated on, you know, oh, I need to get that, I have to get rid of that. And yet there's a whole different way out there, a whole different perspective of seeing and feeling, you know, someone else's suffering and being drawn and moved to act in response to that suffering. Not out of aversion, but out of love. So this is a huge difference in reactivity and what I could say, responsiveness. The mind of wisdom is responsive. You know, if you're standing on a street and you see a small child, you know, running out into the street and there's a car coming, you know, you don't go, oh, things as they are. You act. And there may be some fear there, but you act out of compassion. Don't want that child to be harmed. As we explore our experience from this perspective of not me, not mine, impermanence, this is nature, just seeing experience arising and being known, just star stuff. That's what this is, star stuff. And begins to be experience, the deepening of wisdom, the fruition, really, of understanding. We begin to see how wisdom supports a loosening of suffering. And maybe initially it's a simple turning of, you know, recognizing, oh, you know, what's actually happening? You know, in that moment when my mind shifted and recognized, oh, what's happening here is there's anger here. You know, the acknowledgement of that, the possibility of saying, oh, that's what's happening, can create a sense of space around the experience. You know, this experience of recognizing what's happening as something that's happening in the moment, oh, this is just depression, or this is just irritation, or this is just wanting. You know, there's a little bit of discomfort there, but I can sit with that. This is what it feels like to want seconds. You know, sit with that wanting. As we sit with it, we see something different, or a kind of a, okay, yeah, it's okay to sit with this. It's like what happens in that space as we allow a kind of a bigger container in which that experience can happen. To me, there's this new analogy around wisdom that somebody brought up the word at one of my Dharma talks a few weeks ago of, like, you know, they feel like they have a new enzyme in their life. You know, wisdom is kind of like this enzyme that knows how to transform suffering into understanding. And, you know, there's as we see something like, you know, anger arising. The enzyme of wisdom helps us to, help. Essentially, the enzyme of wisdom will begin to clear away and allow a loosening of all of the parts of that that are, you know, reactive and tight and and are rigid and unwilling to broaden the perspective. But it, you know, often our reactivity also has in it, you know, it's so much of our reactivity when we begin to open to it with wisdom. We see that, you know, in there is the wish for our own well-being, our own happiness, our own safety. And yet, you know, there's a confusion around how that might come about. And so this enzyme of wisdom begins to digest and clear away the reactivity and begins to expose the deeper kind of wish for my own safety, well-being, my own strength, that capacity to be present. And it clears the ground. And we start to see not only that thread towards metta, but also the thread towards truth. Impermanent, experiences impermanent, unreliable, out of control. So this wisdom begins to create a clearing such that we can see the truth more. Letting us see that so much of our reactivity is kind of this collision between our deep wishes for our own happiness and well-being and this impermanent, unreliable, out of control experience. And sometimes we feel that either those wishes, you know, when we see both of those things, we might feel that either those wishes are invalid or those truths should not be there. And what wisdom does is allows our heart to stretch, to hold both the love and the truth. And the heart breaks. But it's a breaking that allows an expanding rather than a contracting. So let's just sit for a moment.